Now, if Vife... Sorry.
If Vife president...
Yeah, exactly. I'll just do that over again. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden could name his running mate as early as the end of this week, according to the timeline that he previously laid out. Now, if vice presidential picks have direct electoral consequences, they're usually pretty limited. But VP picks and how the media covers them can shape views of a presidential ticket overall. So today, we're going to discuss how some of Biden's potential choices could influence the way Americans view his campaign, both positively and negatively. We're also going to take a look at why President Trump is sending federal agents into American cities and how it relates to his re-election message. And here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
So how's the model coming?
The model is about 98.5% done. I want to be clear to our readers, it's going to be a lag between when kind of I finish the code and we test things and debug things and finish the visualizations. But, you know, at least on my end.
So what's your prediction for when the model will be out?
Is there a model for, yeah.
Is there a forecast?
There's a high confidence interval. But, you know, but we're getting there. I don't know. This audience would probably disagree with this. I don't think the world is, like, clamoring in a year like this for us to be extra early to put probabilities on things. We have our polling averages up for a month or two now. But soon you will have those probabilities to argue about. You will have all the meta crap about 2016 and
all right.
You know,
well,
a lot to look forward to.
And, of course, also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And senior politics writer Perry Beacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Hi, Gil.
Let's talk about the federal agents in Portland and potentially other cities. The Trump administration's use of those federal agents in American cities has become a flashpoint. What appear to be customs and border protection agents have been patrolling the federal courthouse in Portland for weeks, spurring further protests against their presence. President Trump also said this past week that he plans to send federal agents to quell violent crime in Chicago and Albuquerque, New Mexico. He also threatened to send agents into other democratically controlled cities. And this comes at a time when the president is also ramping up his reelection campaign messaging around the threat of violent crime. So we know President Trump's stated goal here, which is to combat violent crime in American cities. Nate, do you think we should take him at his word, given the broader political context here?
That he wants to combat violent crime?
Yes.
I don't think Trump is a huge fan of violent crime, nor am I should say. No, look, I mean, this is kind of catnip for Trump to pursue a law and order strategy. You know, we should keep in mind, though, that Americans do not like how he's handled the protests in general, in particular. The handling of the protests in D.C. and the Bible moment seem to be maybe, to the extent there are inflection points in his approval numbers, seem to be a real downtick in his numbers. I mean, maybe you could argue that, like, the protesters in Portland are slightly less sympathetic because they're kind of, the connections between what they're protesting over are a little bit more ambiguous. But I don't know. I mean, look, Trump is kind of flailing around. The response to the coronavirus is not going well. The economy is in bad shape. People think that anything he says on race relations tends to make things worse, right? And so maybe if in Portland, the connection to race relations is a little bit less obvious. But no, I don't think there's anything, like, apart from, you know, fairly cynical and perhaps unsuccessful political strategy at work here, right?
Yeah. Perry and Claire, do you agree with that assessment? Is it fair to call the Fed's actions in Portland and now Chicago and potentially other cities part of a political campaign?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Trump has been pretty explicit in the way that he's talked about the deployment or potential deployment of these federal troops. He's specifically said, look at these democratically run cities that are, you know, running amok. It seems to be part of this appeal to suburbanites, who I think we might talk about later. I think Trump might fundamentally misunderstand the political leanings of suburban America right now. But he does talk about deploying this federal force in democratic cities. I should also say that the notion that a federal force should be deployed to combat crime in cities, violent crime included. There's obviously an uptick in violent crime in cities across the country over the past few weeks. But the notion that I heard the Lawfare podcast, someone call it a lawful but awful use of federal force. I mean, you know, with the consent of the governor of California during the 92 riots in LA, there was, you know, National Guard brought in. But the fact that the federal government, without the consent and in fact against the express wishes of state and local officials, is bringing in this odd assortment of federal agencies. I mean, I think the nature of like Homeland Security is kind of a whole, that agency is kind of a whole separate interesting discussion. But it's quite unprecedented, I think, for it to be a kind of against the express wishes of local and state officials.
I'm not sure how electoral this is, if only because I think he might have done this in 2019 or in 2017 if there were protests going on. I think Trump does not like protest. He does not like protest about, he sort of doesn't like this sort of sense of disorder. He has some authoritarian instincts, I would say. So the idea of sending a police force is not, you know, clear what agency is from. This is how he sees the world in a certain way. So I actually just think, if the DHS staff came to him with this idea, it's the kind of thing he's likely to like and approve, you know, attacking liberal cities. He, I'm sure, doesn't like Portland or Baltimore or Chicago for reasons that have nothing to do with, like, electoral politics. I just think this fits his instincts, and he sort of likes this approach. He doesn't like protests, and here we are.
Well, I also think that the fact it's an election year and he's sort of fallen down on pandemic response probably does have a lot to do with the fact that he's making a big deal about deploying this force, making his political ads about public safety, right? You have the empty 911 control center in these Trump ads. So I do think there's a big element of he's decided that this is like the big note that he can strike during this time when he has not done very well on a lot of the sort of bureaucratic response to the pandemic.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply this is some strategy that makes Trump uncomfortable for any reason, right? I mean, like a lot of people, Trump tends to view what he has impulses to do anyway, for whatever reasons, as being electorally advantageous, and convinces himself that there's no trade-off between my personal biases and desires and what's going to help me win re-election, right? So I don't know you can draw a clear distinction there.
Yeah, Claire, you just mentioned the ads that Trump's campaign has released over the past several weeks that kind of get at this re-election message of law and order and the threat of violent crime. Let's listen to one so we can talk about that further in the context of the overall campaign.
You have reached the 911 police emergency line. Due to defunding of the police department, we're sorry, but no one is here to take your call. If you're calling to report a rape, please press 1. To report a murder, press 2. To report a home invasion, press 3. For all other crimes, leave your name and number, and someone will get back to you. Our estimated wait time is currently 5 days. Goodbye.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
And then what flashes across the screen there at the end is, you won't be safe in Joe Biden's America. I mean, it seems pretty overt here, right? That this is all part of a single message, a single campaign. Perry, I mean, do you see otherwise here?
Yeah, I would say defunding the police is unpopular and a good thing to run on. I would say sending troops to Portland or sending DHS to Portland, I haven't seen a lot of polls in it. I'm guessing it's not going to poll well. And this whole idea of Joe Biden's plan to integrate the suburbs is bad because it's going to make the suburbs bad, I think, depending on how you frame that, might be popular, probably won't be popular because the nature of who lives in the suburbs now is not all white people, and all white people do not respond to that message well. So I think the ads about defunding the police are certainly electoral. I would maybe isolate the sending the police to cities as different. I mean, part of it is like, whether something is electoral, all things, you know, everything he does, I'm sure has some electoral context. I just think the defund the police thing is a particular response, this particular moment that I think you'll hear him mention in the debates and mention, like, I'm not like in, if we have debates, I'm sure Donald Trump will mention defunding the police and try to challenge Biden on that issue about police funding. I don't think in the debates, Trump will be like, you know, talking about what happened in Portland that much. Maybe I'm wrong, but we'll see.
Wait, Perry, what's the distinction you're making here? You're saying it's not electorally motivated. It's just something that he would do anyway.
Yes. I think that he would send the DHS forces to Portland in 2019 or any other times. I think that's what he believes, is that protests are kind of bad. And so my view is sometimes Trump does something weird and we kind of are like, is covered for a few days. His staff tells New York Times reporter X, obviously this is part of our strategy to do X. And sometimes it feels like they're sort of retrofitting his instincts into that as opposed to what's actually going on.
Yeah, but even if they're retrofitting, it still is like, I guess it's their, maybe it's not good electoral strategy, but it is their strategy, right? I mean,
I'm not sure it's their strategy electorally, but it's their strategy for what they're doing right now because they don't protest.
I mean, it's kind of like they seem to be operating on like a late 60s, early 70s understanding of who makes up the suburbs. So like, that's weird. Maybe he's just getting terrible information. I don't know. But it's, I mean, to me, it's like, maybe there's a fine distinction, but does it particularly matter in an election year? I mean, they're not, until we see proof, like, this kind of is what they believe
to be. I think the president
proper.
Is behaving in authoritarian ways.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't...
And the president is behaving in authoritarian ways. He wants to win the election. Are related issues that still have some differences, because I assume he'll do this in 2021 as well. So it's, like, worth thinking. Also, to be honest, like, news media coverage of electoral strategies tends to frame them differently than coverage of just things that are going on. I think it's important to say he'd be doing this anyway. I'm not sure if something happening in election year is electoral. I'm not going to pretend that it's not relevant, but I don't think it's like the dominant reason what this is happening, I would say, is not political strategy.
Right. I think a lot of people just saw this, and maybe it's falling into the trap that you've described, Perry, as similar to the caravan surrounding the midterms and sending troops to the southern border to kind of draw attention to what President Trump sees as a potentially winning message, which is, in that case, immigration, which did help him in 2016, and in this case, law and order, which he, I guess, perhaps as a student of history, sees as having helped Nixon or Reagan or something like that.
They lost the popular vote for the House by 9 points, which is a gigantic number, right? It's another debate. It's not as clear to me as the conventional wisdom might hold how much immigration helped Trump in 2016.
Ooh, that's a hot take.
As opposed to issues with Clinton, ranging from sexism to her emails to whatever else, right?
At least in the primary. Would you give him that? Immigration helped him win the primary?
Sure. Yeah. But like, Trump has been trying to recreate his... I mean, look, I'm not quite sure what the right analogy is here, right? But people come up with, I guess I'm basically agreeing with Perry, people come up with rationalizations very effectively. Human beings are very wise at finding ways to rationalize their impulsive.
Yeah, but I guess I don't understand the distinction that we're all, it's like, it's electoral strategy, it's election strategy, it's authoritarianism. I don't understand what, like, why we need the distinction drawn around each of those separate areas. I guess that's my confusion, is like, a person's election strategy might be authoritarian, and they might do it anyway, but they're doing it. Therefore, it is their strategy. It seems sort of circular.
I guess maybe I want to kind of rescind, I think, the thing I said at first in response to Gillen, where I said it was cynical. Like, now that I think about it, hearing you guys, I think that's maybe the wrong framing. You know, it may be terrible. It may be authoritarian, right? I don't think it's cynical in the sense that, oh, I'm only doing this because I want to win re-election, right? I'm not just going to help him to win re-election, right? I think Trump is happy to have police crack down on liberal mixed race protesters under any circumstance.
That's a good way to put it. In fact, as I might say, even if the polls show this is not a particularly useful tactic, I still think Trump might keep doing it. So I guess then it's a bad political strategy, but I sort of feel like if someone will do something, if they read the polls, it's not proper, they'll keep doing it. I'm not going to call it a political strategy. I'm going to call it like what
but it
their
is.
Views
but
are.
It, but that's what, but it is. Like, it's a bad political strategy. Just because it's bad doesn't mean it's like not a strategy.
Well, okay. I mean, I think somewhere in here, there's a somewhat nuanced view of like what exactly Trump is doing, how it relates to his views of what will get him reelected versus his general tendencies. One question I have in all of this is, you're saying that it's probably not popular now. Is there any sense that Trump, through the bully pulpit of the presidency and by putting a lot of focus on this, can raise the importance level of violent crime and desire for law and order amongst the general public in order to make it a more important election issue? Just to cite some numbers here, you know, in a Pew poll from July, 41% of Americans said violent crime is a big problem in America. That's compared with 58% who say that the coronavirus outbreak is, and 63% who say that ethics in government is. And then a Gallup poll showed that 3% of Americans said crime is the most important issue facing the country. Do you think Trump is making a bid here to try to up those numbers?
I think the answer to the question is yes. The question I would have is, like, is this the best way to do that? Like, you could imagine a strategy in which you talk about Chicago and violence in Chicago nonstop, and like, and which he did to some extent in 16, and sort of talked about that in a way maybe the media would amplify it. Like, I think the media is perfectly willing to amplify claims of high crime in urban areas. The media's been doing that for a long time. I think it would be smarter to talk about that as opposed to sending in federal forces who are from unnamed agencies, because then you're going to get the critique that you're like violating norms and so on. I think if Trump wanted to do that, I actually think elevating crime as an issue is probably pretty smart if you can do that. I don't think we're watching a good demonstration of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a question of like, if he were a more effective authoritarian, right, who did understand the politics behind this, right? I mean, look, I think obviously it's not a given that Biden will win the election, right? What are some scenarios by which Trump wins? It probably involves some combination of the coronavirus numbers getting better by fall, maybe despite Trump, frankly, and views of the other issues kind of somehow spinning to a different place, right? Like, maybe there are at some point some protesters, or I don't know if you want to call them protesters, right? Some people kind of adjacent to the protests who act violently, and that kind of, and there's some violence toward law enforcement or, you know, private citizens or something. I mean, you can imagine that, like, these are unpredictable kind of powder kegs to some extent, and you can imagine things spinning out in a lot of different ways, right? But in general, people don't trust Trump on these issues at all. So he's like kind of playing, if we want to kind of treat it seriously as a kind of strategy, you know, he's playing kind of a strategy that on average might make matters worse for him, but maybe X percent of the time kind of a Hail Mary works and something changes in public views about these protests. I mean, at least in theory, you know, people might also have different views in private about these protests than they might state publicly. And again, I think people are supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think kind of the more firm the connection is between the protests and Black Lives Matter, then I think it actually is harmful for Trump, right? And the more tenuous that connection gets, then people may reassess a little bit. But if it's a stretch, it's a pretty desperate strategy. You can argue that, like, he's in a desperate position, down 8 or 9 points in the polls. But that's, you know, if you burn all your bridges because you screwed everything else up, then you don't have much to lose, I guess.
Yeah, and it's just maybe just worth saying here, because we tracked it earlier on in the process but haven't talked about it so much lately. Trump's at negative 20 when it comes to his approval rating for handling the coronavirus. And it's just been ticking down steadily over these past months. And so perhaps changing the subject, making a different appeal is, as you mentioned, the Hail Mary strategy. Claire, you mentioned earlier on that Trump may be trying to make an appeal to the suburbs and that he may not entirely understand the politics of the suburbs. Can you flesh that out a little bit more for us? You know, how is Trump doing in the suburbs, and why don't you think this is maybe the best strategy?
Well, he's not doing particularly well right now in the suburbs. And, you know, I think Trump potentially has this view in his mind of the suburbs as this still very conservative white bastion. Now, a lot of American suburbs are very white. It's actually not very common for Americans to live in mixed race neighborhoods. All of that is true. But what's also true about the suburbs is that they have crept more towards the Democratic side of things over the past few elections. White college educated Americans which I think is a pretty often easy shorthand for the kind of people who live in suburbs, are creeping more and more Democratic leaning. We've gone over the numbers, you know, almost every week on this podcast about how most of the majority of Americans view Trump as bad on race relations, right? So I think people do also, it's no longer kind of like, oh, well, I don't know if he's really being kind of, he's not trampling on race issues. I think people see him as inflaming a pretty problematic racial issue in the country, which I think a lot of people care about. And I don't think that's something that plays particularly well in the suburbs. You know, if it were, I think Nate and Perry were saying before, you could see someone having a smarter strategy to play up, you know, worries about crime. And maybe that would be a more sober policy conversation about it would be catastrophic to defund the police and here's why, rather than like sending in troops. Trump's also doing some interesting stuff around he wants to roll back some housing laws, which is, I'm a little surprised by that, honestly. It seems like a little bit of out of left field, but I guess kind of plays into, you know, racial tensions in America. But I think fundamentally Trump is kind of misunderstanding the political leanings of the suburbs, which are more diverse, I think, than he thinks or that he's speaking to, and are also just more liberal than they once were.
So there's a regulation that was passed in the later years of the Obama administration that was intended to basically force some suburbs to racially integrate, make it easier for people of different races, of lower income people to move into suburbs. So the Trump administration in the last few weeks has reversed that policy. I think it was a housing department policy, so not a law. And they've been advertising that some, and Trump's been talking about, I'm going to save the suburbs. And I think Obama administration supported this policy, so Joe Biden supports this policy. So if you think of Trump as trying to appeal to, let's say, white people, because the suburbs include some minorities, but I don't think he's really trying to appeal to those people. I do think that there is some, you know, if you can portray these integration ideas being overly aggressive, could that work? I think that could work for some politicians. I think probably not Donald Trump, because so many people think he's racist. I think that the crime issue overall, if we're talking about like defunding the police, I think that still is a good issue for him. If he can get Biden, they're trying to goad Biden into suggesting he would cut some police funding somewhere. Biden, being a non-idiot and having read the polls, is not going for that so far. But that they're trying to goad Biden to a crime discussion where Trump is for the police and Biden isn't. One thing Nate said that jumped out at me was about, but the one thing about Portland that I think is useful to think about is Trump needs to decouple issues from race. And the one thing about Portland is it's a basically all white city with protesters. One thing that does make this electoral and political is that if you're going to pick a city to pick on, I think Trump and his team did pick the right one, because Portland is a sea of white protesters. They made a mistake in one sense, though. Once all those moms showed up to join the protests, again, I think that hurts Trump, because once it's like mothers and people who look like the swing voter, white mothers, I think being against white mothers is bad, but if the protesters were mainly like younger people, younger white men, that might have been a good scenario. But I think the Portland dynamic is complicated for that reason.
Yeah, the redlining stuff, or the trying to like roll back anti-redlining rules by Trump, is interesting, because I think lots of politicians and lots of politics in liberal cities kind of revolve around these like NIMBYism instincts, right? The not in my backyard kind of instincts, where it's, you know, people want to live in a neighborhood kid to the good public school, not the bad one. There's lots of fights around housing, right? And how it interacts with public services. This happens in California politics, right? Renters versus owners in big cities. And you can see how this does have some appeal. Parents who are worried about, you know, busing happening. I grew up in a town that had busing, and it was a liberal town, and there were really big divides over, is this bad for our schools? Is this bad for our children? You can see the ways that that stuff plays into people's fears. I do think they're racial fears, but it is, I think Perry's right, where everyone just kind of, with a different politician, you might be able to kind of have a more respectable quote unquote conversation around it. But with Trump, it just reads straight up as like, because he kind of says, I'm not going to let the outsiders ruin the suburbs. I mean, there's not much reading between the lines to be done.
I mean, he tweeted at, quote, Suburban Housewives of America, and then said, quote, Biden will destroy your neighborhood and your American dream. I will preserve it and make it even better.
I mean, there's Studies thesis in that thing, like the American dream, like, what is that?
Suburban Housewives of America, yes. Which, like, when you think about the suburbs, oftentimes you think of, you know,
Betty Draper.
Homes where two parents work. So, I mean, yeah, it is like maybe a potential mismatch. Politico did a pretty long piece titled Donald Trump's Suburban Horror Show, where it described Trump down, you know, between 9 and 11 points in the suburbs. He won the suburbs in 2016 by 4 points. They point out that the suburbs are now a third non-white and then 2/3 white. It's more diverse. There aren't the same racial attitudes necessarily as there were in the 60s and 70s. So this appeal is pretty bluntly getting at some of those dynamics, trying to turn his fortunes around in the suburbs. Nate, is it fair to say that the 2020 election kind of hinges on how the suburbs go?
I mean, look, the extent that rural areas generally vote Republican and urban areas generally vote Democratic, then it's the medium density areas that tend to be the swing parts of different states. Sure. We could have a whole podcast episode of how you define the suburbs versus small towns versus relation to distance from the big city. By the way, especially in the House, I mean, I don't think Trump really cares at all about how Republicans do down ballot. He just wants to win himself, right? Certainly for the House, then the suburbs were a big part of why Democrats made their gains in 2018, because a lot of districts that were drawn to be, you know, red-leaning conservative suburbs have now turned purple or even blue in some cases. You know, it's a problem in some of these kind of southern states and so forth.
All right, well, we will, of course, keep tabs on whether this changes anything in the suburbs. But let's move on and discuss some of the pros and cons of Joe Biden's potential vice presidential picks.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Ready to make the smartest choice for your business? Say hello to Shopify, the global commerce platform that makes selling a breeze. Whether you're starting your online shop, opening your first physical store, or hitting a million orders, Shopify is your growth partner. Sell everywhere with Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. Turn browsers into buyers with Shopify's best converting checkout, 36% better than other platforms. Effortlessly sell more with Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and supports global brands like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen? Join millions of successful entrepreneurs across 175 countries backed by Shopify's extensive support and help resources. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Start your success story today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. shopify.com/538.
Joe Biden previously said that he would announce his pick for a running mate around August 1st, which is this coming Saturday. And that's a self-imposed deadline, so the announcement could come anytime between then and the convention, presumably. And the convention is on August 17th. So, you know, about 2 weeks in here where we'll officially be in high season for VP speculation. And we'll kick things off right here on this podcast, although, of course, they've been kicked off in other publications as well. Maybe not necessarily speculating so much as talking about how the different picks could influence views of the campaign. Now, I mentioned earlier that direct electoral consequences of a vice presidential pick are not so clear and limited if they do exist. But just to kind of get those out there, what are the potential effects? Like, are there geographic or demographic effects at all?
So there are some fairly modest geographic effects. However, they tend to be, this is pretty geeky, they tend to be kind of inversely proportional to how big the state is. So if you are to pick a VP candidate from Alaska or Wyoming or Delaware, to name some recent examples of VP states, that politician probably has a big effect there, but it's a small state that wouldn't necessarily win you very much. If you pick a VP from California or Florida or New York or Texas, then it's likely a lot more minor. So, you know, it might be worth a point or two. And a point or two in the key state might not be nothing, but it's not a huge effect.
All right. So perhaps they can be more important in how they shape views of the ticket overall and the media narratives that emerge. So let's talk about some of the, you know, positive or negative spin, pros and cons that could come out of Biden's possible selections. Perry, why don't you kick things off for us? And do you want to pick someone to talk about, or should I throw it to you?
I'll pick Harris. I think she's the most obvious person, so I'll just go from there.
Is she the clear front runner right now, would you say?
I'm going to say yes. I'm sure people will debate this. But yes, I think she's the sort of most logical person that everyone in politics thinks will be picked, even if they don't say it. A lot of people think will be picked. So in terms of the media narrative, I'll just describe it this way. So if she gets picked, I think the coverage is Joe Biden picks someone who ran for president, who seemed like the logical person to pick in certain ways. This pick both acknowledges the big role that Black people play in the Democratic Party, and also in some ways is probably a reaction to the protests we've seen the last few months, and it sort of shows Joe Biden is trying to be in touch with that movement. It'll be probably less about her as an individual on some level and more about sort of her dynamics as a leading Black female politician. It'll also be framed in that historical nature of we've never had a Black woman on the national ticket before. So the positive of that is that, you know, actually in this case, I'm not totally sure. That'll be sort of the positive coverage that'll be that Joe Biden is trying to respond to this moment in America. I think that in my view, the negative of that will be it'll be Black, 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 Black. It will be the coverage of Harris. And I'm not totally sure that's helpful in the country that I live in.
Yeah. Harris is interesting. I mean, in some ways, she sort of practically takes some worries away from the campaign because she's a experienced campaigner. She knows how to comport herself on the national level. She's a good speaker. She can be kind of compelling. What's so interesting to me about if Harris is picked, and I think Perry, you're right, the conversation will be about her symbolic importance, is she spent a lot of time in her career pushing back against those narratives because she's been the first lots of things. You know, she's been like the first Black female something in a lot of the jobs she's held. And she has been prickly about that kind of up until I think the presidential run, where you kind of have to become a little bit more of a, particularly as a woman and as a Black woman, a little bit more of a softer, embracing character of all of that. But I do think that there still is this spikiness around Kamala Harris when people kind of say, what's it like to be the first? And she'll kind of say, I don't know, I don't think about it, I do my job. And so I could also see her being, you know, in interviews where people ask about her being good at turning the conversation around and talking about, well, I was a prosecutor, which, you know, that's a whole other conversation. You know, there's a way that I think she is deft about handling that question, but it is particularly interesting to me that she is the person, if she's picked, that there'll be a symbolic conversation around, because I think she's probably personally a little bit irritated by that.
Well, I think there's a lot of potential choices, at least on the list, where the conversation will be also a symbolic one about the historic nature of the choice.
Totally.
You mentioned that one thing she might talk about is being a prosecutor. How much do you think the narrative turns to Joe Biden's campaign is not concerned with the worries of the left or the more progressive part of the party?
I think the narrative loves to talk about that topic. I personally don't think that Joe Biden's going to have that many problems getting voters from the left, given the state of the country right now. So I think people talk about it, and they'll probably be fairly in the same category as like discussion of like the letter and cancel culture, right? People love debating, but that isn't necessarily resonant with average Americans or even average very left-leaning Americans.
I do think the prosecutor stuff, and I wish I had brought up my original answer, is going to be discussed. Is it going to change votes? No, and I'm not suggesting it would. But I do think that there will be reporters who go out and interview the protesters, and there will be a great amount of stories about protesters who are black saying, we didn't ask for this person and she doesn't address our concerns. In fact, we think she's bad for the ticket. I think that'll be a narrative that's out there. Whether it's electorally relevant, I'm sure the overall majority of black people will vote for the ticket for Joe Biden, no matter who is running meetings. That's it. That will be a narrative I think is important, and that Biden and Harris have to be sort of prepared for, you know, welcome to the extremely tough on crime ticket. Vote Democratic. You know, that's going to be a challenging discussion to have.
But they might also see it as a positive, right? If the Biden campaign is worried about, you know, they're far ahead of Trump, but if they are worried about 3 months from now as things tighten and people are trying to paint Joe Biden as soft on crime, they can say, like, come on, guys, this is a stupid conversation. Like, Kamala Harris is a prosecutor. She's the good kind of prosecutor, if you're talking to Democrats. But she's a serious person. She's not around here to, like, defund the police. Like, I think in some ways they might see it as an asset, too.
Yeah, I guess given the conversation that we had during the first half of the podcast, of course that will be a dynamic. Let's move on. We got a lot of people to talk about. Let's talk about Tammy Duckworth.
Binders full of women to go through.
Illinois. You heard it here first. Tammy Duckworth, senator from Illinois. What kind of, you know, message does this send about Joe Biden's ticket? How does this get processed in the press?
I think the lead coverage is that she's a veteran and that she's Asian American. And those are the two things that I think will be most mentioned. And I think the other context will be he picked somebody different. He picked somebody we didn't expect. I think that'll come out in the coverage a little bit. He picked a person of color, but not a black person. And it'll go to the fact that he's interested in the diversity of the country, but sort of picked a sort of an unexpected way to go about it. I think the negative coverage would be you're going to get a lot of, like, there's been a whole movement around pick a black person before this. There's been a movement around it since George Floyd's death. So I think you'll get both a critique from certain black elites, and you'll also get critique from certain liberal elites who, you know, who are basically for Elizabeth Warren, who are going to critique Duckworth for not having the right liberal credentials. I think those are the two critiques you'll get, not liberal enough and not black. And those things are things that, again, I don't think are electorally that important, but I think those are the narratives that'll come out that as well.
She's also a very compelling candidate, though, that I think it's, if you're going for someone who's an evocative, inspirational character, I think Duckworth is one of those. I mean, in addition to being, you know, an amputee, a veteran, which I think is probably something that Biden connects with her on, very, like, he is very, like, close to his heart is the sort of the veterans issues, particularly given his son. So I think that that's something that, like, you could probably see him connecting on. I also think the fact that Tammy Duckworth, you know, I think it was like a year or 2 years ago where she was the first senator to bring a child onto the floor. She had kids late in life. Like, there's a lot of connective thread that I think people would like seeing they would see themselves in it. In a time when America is really struggling, these are two people who fundamentally understand what trauma and suffering is, and they're able to pull through. They're kind of like these inspirational figures, so you could see that happening.
What about the, you know, this is something to bring up in a similar vein to what you said, Perry, about the coverage of Harris largely revolving around her being black and whether that is something that stirs up certain anti-black sentiments in the country. You know, Tammy Duckworth was born in Bangkok, Thailand, and considering what happened to Barack Obama and conspiracies about him not being an American, being born in Kenya, et cetera, you know, given that this is the person second in line for the presidency, should we expect the fact that she wasn't born in America to become a calling card of the right or of the conspiratorial far right?
I mean, I think it might become a calling card of the Trump campaign. They're not very subtle about any of this, right? Yeah, I'm sure that will be debated. I'm sure there'll be other dark stuff too, right? Her legs were amputated. And, like, I'm sure any dark anything with anybody when you're dealing with the Trump campaign, right, is going to come out, right? It would often come out with much more traditional campaigns too, but, like, you know, now would that actually hurt her? Would it be another kind of case where kept people left to Biden's and Duckworth's defense and it made Trump and the campaign look worse and he was very clumsy and awkward around it? I'm not saying it would be, like, smart, right, or effective, or it's any reason not to pick her, but would it come out? I mean, of course.
Do you know the way she's answered this in the past? She says, I'm a member of the DAR. What else do you want? Which is kind of an interesting thing for a politician to do. You know, it's obvious that she knew that she would have this problem as she rose through the ranks. And it's, you know, she's in a heritage organization connecting her to the revolution. It's interesting. And she's used that, particularly with like Tucker Carlson.
And DAR being Daughters of the American Revolution.
Yes.
Let's move on and talk about Elizabeth Warren. I guess the choice of the progressive left for the most part, although they have some other people that they've been supporting as well. What's the upshot here?
So the big narrative, I assume the media coverage would be in the middle of a recession, in the middle of a massive recession because of the pandemic, Joe Biden picks expert on, you know, policy expert, economics expert, et cetera. The other narrative would be, of course, Joe Biden, perhaps worried about enthusiasm on the left wing of his party, picks the person who is, you know, one of the liberal icons of the Democratic Party. So those are the two kind of narratives. I think I think the economic expert is the framing that they would like, and sort of Elizabeth Warren, who knows the details of everything, who's the policy expert. We have all these problems in America. She has the plans to fix them. That's the positive narrative. I suspect the negative narrative is left, Bernie Sanders, socialist, very liberal, extremely liberal. And I think that's the thing that'll be a dominant element of it, too. And I'm guessing that'll be the more dominant element.
Yeah, I think Harry's right that note will come out a lot, right? I think some of the framing would be, okay, hopefully I won't piss people off with this too much, right? But some of the framing would be like, Biden was coasting to victory by promising a return to normalcy, and then he nominates radical left Elizabeth Warren, who wants a revolution. You know, I think there'd be some of that framing. I think there would also be questions around, you know, why you're not picking a woman of color in this moment. There might be some questions around age. So, you know, so it's not the most like risk averse choice. I mean, Biden would have to lean into it pretty heavily, right? You'd have to lean into it in terms of saying, we actually do need to think about changing, you know, it's a new normal, and Elizabeth is going to be part of that and kind of leaning into her wonkishness, and she, you know, she can be persuasive campaigner and stuff like that. So part of me thinks, like, because it's so different directionally than the other picks, that like it's less likely to happen.
Yeah.
Because Biden would have to like plan for it, because it's high risk, high reward, I think, relative to some other choices. And like, so if it's her, then maybe she's already been chosen. It's some very, very elaborate smoke screens. I tend to think it's probably not her, in part because you've seen elements of the left starting to argue for other choices a bit too.
And that other choice being maybe Karen Bass, potentially?
Maybe.
Is that who you're referring to?
Yeah. I mean, there's direct kind of people, you know, there's some actually been some of that lately. I mean, we can kind of discuss Karen Bass on her own merits and whether that's necessarily like the most, but you know, but it seems like people on the left reading the tea leaves think that Elizabeth Warren is not a very likely choice. I do not put that much stock in people's kind of secondhand interpretations of tea leaves, but between kind of the strong hints that Biden might want to pick a woman of color, between, you know, just kind of Biden being kind of a risk averse guy, I think it's not one of the more likely picks.
So let's talk about the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Karen Bass, whose name has come up more recently. I think Politico ran a piece last week calling her a potential unity pick. I think unity between the left and more moderate parts of the party being the reference there. She's not a particularly well-known politician. She's not really a national politician. So how does that narrative develop? What are we looking at?
I think it's interesting that she's been brought in later on, and part of her competitive advantage among everyone else is that she kind of fits with the Biden administration as bridge administration, in the sense that people like that she doesn't seem to have outsized political ambitions, that she wouldn't necessarily be spending her 4 years in the White House priming herself for a run. Perhaps there would be, whatever the party decides they want 4 years from now, whether it be, you know, more liberal or younger or whatever it is, that she wouldn't be someone who had a huge stake in plotting a political future, and that she's sort of ideologically satisfies like a more liberal wing. She's a black woman. So it's it's helping with some of the symbolism that you would want on a ticket theoretically. But I do think it's just kind of interesting because she has a low profile. People would be interested in it.
Yeah, I think there'd be two elements of the coverage. It'd be who is that person? Like a little bit like a Sarah Palin-ish. I think that she would have fairly low name ID. I'm not comparing Karen Bass to Sarah Palin, except that I think they would be sort of unknown choices who people don't know. And the second part, I think, would be a lot of focus on, in this moment of George Floyd, you picked a black. There's going to be a lot of focus on black, again, I think would be with her as well. I tend to think, again, I'm not sure that coverage of a person being black is great if you're, you know, running for office in America. And I tend to think the who, I don't know. I mean, I've met Karen Bass a few times. I guess if there's elements of the who is going to mean there's going to be more biographical pieces written about her than if it was Harris or Warren. And we don't know, I don't know personally the details of her biography. Hopefully for her, they're good. But she's not been vetted by the media in the same way. I know that Biden's team has probably went to every country she's ever visited in her life and done a lot of vetting. But the media might uncover things that Biden doesn't. And that's the sort of risk versus Warren and Harris have been vetted in a very extensive way.
It does strike me that they've run a very small C conservative campaign in the general election, right? They are kind of doing the base. I mean, it's not a full basement campaign anymore, but the sense of like kind of low profile, let things ride, don't make big waves does make you think like, oh, they'd probably go with kind of like a safe choice, a known entity, a known quantity, rather than, you know, kind of an interesting, ooh, like, that's an interesting thought. I don't know. There's just something to me about, like, a safety instinct with this campaign, which I think is understandable given the turbulent national climate.
Yeah, I mean, both given that they're 8 or 9 points ahead in the polls and that people want an island of, or illusion of safety, right? I think part of their calculation is probably just, okay, what is the choice that has the least downside, right? Is the
first,
choice
do no
least,
harm.
Yeah. Which is usually the rule of VP picks, but might especially be the rule with this VP pick. Does someone who's relatively anonymous, like Karen Bass, represent less risk because she won't get in the way of anything, right? Or is someone like Kamala Harris less risk because people know her name more? Although with Kamala Harris, it's a bit of a mixed signal in that she did campaign and get vetted pretty extensively. Her campaign did not go super well, right? So you wouldn't say this is a person who aced the dynamics of campaigning, although many unsuccessful presidential candidates, including Joe Biden himself, have later on become successful winning VP nominees. But I don't know. I mean, some of this feels like it's kind of like the balance between safety and other considerations, right? And kind of qualifications and you know, maybe that leads in the directions that we're going to talk about in the future here, like Susan Rice or something, right? But if you kind of, this is an exercise in like the Biden campaign trying to calibrate what's the least downside, then I think it's probably a decent paradigm for what they're doing.
Yeah, let's move on and talk about some of the possibilities that Joe Biden is considering that may be lesser known.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Susan Rice, as you mentioned, Nate, has come to the fore, I think in part because of her close relationship already with Joe Biden, the fact that she is a black woman. And, you know, she has plenty of experience in Washington, although, of course, she has never been a candidate, never won elected office. What is the pro and con of a choice like that? It doesn't seem to fit with prioritizing a conservative pick in the sense that she's, you know, hasn't won elected office.
So I think the narrative will be two things. There'll be, of course, she's a black woman speaking to this moment. I think that'll be an obvious one. I think there'll be a Joe Biden is running the sort of Obama restoration campaign, and he picked one of Obama's senior advisors who was with Obama the entire time he was in office. I think that'll be a big part of the narrative. And another big part will be the sort of like, there'll be a little bit of the Benghazi. Susan Rice made a controversial statement about Benghazi right after. Will the Republicans take advantage of this? Are we redoing the Obama years over again? I think that'll be a big narrative as well. And then that sort of fourth narrative will be, she's never run for office, but she actually has a lot of experience in government. And I think that'll sort of cut both ways. In some ways, like, having somebody who has not been running around running president for a long time actually might to voters be an advantage of sorts. Like we pick somebody who's not necessarily been, you know, trying to aspire for president since day one. We pick somebody whose credentials scream, I want to do the job, as opposed to I want to give speeches and talk a lot. So that's like one that might be a positive or a negative. I don't know. The Benghazi coverage, I think, will come up and is definitely a negative, and I'm sure something they're thinking about. I think the Obama restoration is a great potential thing for them. I think a lot of people, Obama's very popular. It's sort of like, we're going to return to normal. Joe Biden and Susan Rice sort of reinforces that ticket. I sort of think, when I think about the picks here, this Susan Rice is someone I'm thinking about. You know, I think I'm going to be writing the initial piece for 538 when somebody gets picked. And I'm thinking more seriously about Susan Rice than most people we've talked about, because that pick makes a lot of sense to me when I think about how the media would cover it.
Yeah, it's definitely the return to the Obama administration. Biden spent so much of the primary campaign reminding voters that he was Barack Obama's vice president and, like, you know, the halcyon days. Rice is like she's sort of like a pillar of competency, in the sense of, like, she's not like someone I think who gets up on a stump and like oozes that campaigny charm. She's a policy person. She's a wonky person, which is not to say she doesn't do a lot of public speaking, but I would be interested to see, like, again, this goes to the weird nature of the campaign this year, how much she would be like out on the campaign trail, virtual or not, and how much it would be like Susan Rice is doing a really hands-on work with, like, the transition, because, you know, we think that this is going to be, we need to be, you know, ready even before day one, whatever it is. Like, I'd kind of be curious to see what sort of spin they'd put on her as kind of like getting back immediately to work. This is someone who's super familiar with government, the bridge with Obama, the invisible bridge or whatever it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, or visible. I mean, I think Biden wants that to be explicit. And he's like, I will campaign for Obama's third term, and that's fine. I'll own that. For some reason, I'm not like able to be, maybe it's staying up too late to work on the model. I'm not being able to be quite as articulate as I'd want to be. But there is something about, like, if you want someone who is a safe pick, right? She was in the White House, UN ambassador, the National Security Advisor for the entirety of Obama's 8 years in office, right? So there's some degree of vetting office has taken place. She has national security credentials. She may not have campaigned for office before, right? But then, okay, of the people that had run national campaigns, most of them are not on the shortlist anyway. And like I mentioned earlier, the one who did, Kamala Harris, had kind of a mixed success, shall we say, as a national candidate. And so, you know, you can understand, like Perry said, kind of why Biden might be led here from kind of the, you know, the risk-averse paradigm.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to risk aversion, you do have to wonder both the not previously elected and two, her nomination to Secretary of State got, you know, well, held up and then quashed because of the whole Benghazi story and how she came out and said that the attack on the consulate there had to do with an anti-Muhammad video that people were angry about. And that ended up not being the case. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of politics involved in the degree to which Benghazi was emphasized during the Obama years. But, you would be curious to see how the campaign thinks about dealing with that.
Yeah, she's also, like, I don't know how much this would come up if they picked her, but she's also, like, incredibly ensconced in Washington. Like, I believe her family, like, her mother was very good friends with Madeleine Albright. Like, it's a very, like, D.C., she's a very D.C. person, not just career-wise, but I think, like, upbringing-wise. So I'd kind of be curious, and who knows if that's going to, if people would even pay that much attention to it. But it's just, like, an interesting thing, particularly when you think back to 2016 and Trump constantly beating the outsider drum.
All right, so who should we talk about next? There's still a lot of people on the list of possibles. Anyone got a choice?
Val Demings, I think, was an interesting pick, or would be an interesting pick. I know that she's fallen off a little bit. I don't know why we're talking about the Scottish teens again, which is a reference, of course, to political prediction markets. At one point, Val Demings was rocketing up those standings, the conventional wisdom, and now it's kind of, she's fallen back a little bit. But, you know, former chief of the Orlando police from not a swing district in Florida, but from a swing state in Florida, you know, would be kind of, you know, has some political experience, obviously running for office. I mean, that, you know, on the surface, there would seem to be a lot of positives there, right? I do wonder if there are concerns on the left or whatever else about, like, people call Kamala Harris a cop. I mean, this is a woman who, like, literally was a cop, right? And I'm sure there would be examination of her tenure in Orlando. But, you know, but seems like a fairly logical set of criteria that Biden might pick her by.
We don't have to guess. Politico has already done a story on her time as in Orlando, in which they suggested she was pretty defensive of officers who were involved in controversial incidents. So I think that we don't have to guess. That story is already out. I think that would be a real problem for her, even more than Harris. That would be a big part of the media narrative and a one they'd really have to think about if they picked her.
I mean, couldn't that kind of triangulate a little bit to Biden's benefit, right? We're like, oh my God, she might be too conservative on these issues, right? I mean, even though the country is, like, very concerned with police violence, you know, I'm not sure that it wouldn't be a little bit like Biden himself, right? Where, I mean, half the time when people on the left are like, oh, Biden is too moderate, I wonder if that actually helps Biden net-net versus the rest of the electorate.
I think that the electorate and the media narrative are on these issues very different things. I agree with you on the electorate part. It may not be the worst to have the left saying she's a black woman, but she's too conservative. I would not want to be sort of Biden's staff having to deal with the first 5 days of people bringing up, like, this person in Orlando who's an officer. I don't know. There is some risk that the debate about policing and the Democratic Party, you get criticized too much for sort of taking the, you know, sort of the younger black vote for granted to some extent. I think there would be a lot of complaining with the Demings-Biden ticket. Does that matter? If you win more whites, I'd rather have white swing voters than black people under 30, because those one group is much bigger than the other. But I think that one would be, that'd be interesting to see. And I think that one would be a media narrative I would not want to do. Harris ran for president and was able to get the policing issue sort of off the table to some extent. I wonder if Demings spend 2 weeks on that with her.
I mean, if you're a mayor or if you're a police chief, you're kind of going to be inextricably tied to your police department because it's your job to defend them, you know? So I think you get into this problem with, like, black, white, whatever, like, state and city officials will have at some point been on the record defending officer actions or controversial actions, probably.
Speaking of mayors, somebody who's been on the list for a long time, I think has been acknowledged to be on the short list still, is Keisha Lance Bottoms, mayor of Atlanta. What are the ups and downs there?
I think the coverage will in part be, I think she's perceived, right or wrong, I've not studied this, to be handling COVID in a fairly aggressive way. And, like, you could see, like, the pick is Joe Biden, you know, in the time of COVID and George Floyd, Joe Biden picks a vice president, someone who's perceived to be fighting COVID pretty well, leading that effort, and also someone who fired their police chief in the last few months in the midst of this controversy, suggesting she's sort of, like, aware of what's happening on racial issues in the country. So I think that is those are the two things. And along with the other bigger narrative being Joe Biden picked the mayor of a place who happens to be black. So I think there'll be definitely a sort of implied kind of affirmative action, maybe she's not qualified part of that too, that I think would be in the coverage, if not stated directly, then sort of implied. So, and picking a mayor would be unusual. We just haven't had a lot of mayors pick for VP recently. So she's been on TV a lot. She's very good on TV, I would say. So I think that she might be able to explain her qualifications pretty well in this time in the world's history, being a black mayor of a big town. So I think this is, but I do think the other narrative that she is maybe unqualified will also show up.
I think being a responsive coronavirus public official, particularly in the South, probably provides an advantageous contrast. And I think it's also, you know, I don't know if we're going to, how much we're going to talk about like Stacey Abrams, but the idea that if you want to pick someone from a state that would be like a real wonderful win for Democrats, like Georgia would be really interesting. And Nate, I'm kind of curious to hear, you know, you were saying at the top of this segment that depending on the size of the state, the candidate, the potential VP from a state might have like negligible effects. I'm kind of curious what you think about the, let's say the Georgia and the Michigan situation, like those size and potential VP effects for those particular states.
And let's add in here, of course, you know, when you're talking about Michigan, you're talking about Gretchen Whitmer, and the other option for Georgia, as you mentioned, is Stacey Abrams. Nate, talk about that.
Yeah, Georgia is one of the more interesting ones, right? It's a medium-sized state. It's a state that currently is competitive, but I think is not that close to what we call the tipping point, meaning a state that could be decisive. So in theory, leaning heavily into Georgia could be interesting. You know, Brian Kemp's response, the Republican governor, is increasingly unpopular there in Georgia, which has had its own fairly bad outbreak. It might be a little much. I mean, one thing to remember about Georgia is that it's what it's pretty polarized. We sometimes call it, it's not very elastic, meaning that like, yeah, Georgia is close to 50-50, but it's kind of hard for Democrats to get over the hump because the electorate is divided between black voters and upwardly mobile urban white and Asian professionals in cities like Atlanta on the one hand, and then very conservative white evangelicals in many other parts of the state on the other hand, right? So it's like you don't necessarily have that many swing voters. But you know, it'd be a logical pick, right? I think if Biden were 4 points ahead instead of 8 points ahead, then he might be a little bit more inclined to go in that direction. I mean, I think both she and Abrams have like have real upside, right?
In terms of how the media narrative evolves around Biden's ticket, with both Gretchen Whitmer and Keisha Lance Bottoms, is the campaign kind of tying itself to the COVID outcomes in those two states in the run-up to the election? And is that a potential reason that a risk-averse campaign would steer away from somebody who has executive experience at a time like this?
You could probably argue it either way in Georgia, right? If cases go down, then you say, okay, it's because of Mayor Bottoms and what cities like Atlanta are doing, right? And they show this could be effective. If cases get worse, you could say this is because Brian Kemp feuded with her and was not listening to the science, right? You could probably play that either way, I think. I do think, as talked about on my weekly ABC News segment, which I hope you're turning into, do you buy that? I do think that, like, maybe the punditry a little bit underrates the chance that like there is a lot we don't know about coronavirus. Maybe something's come together and things seem to be demonstrably improving by November in general, it's worth for the Biden campaign. But I don't think it's like a Georgia specific risk.
Let's answer your question. I agree with you, Galen. I don't know if you asked the question, but I actually think now that I've thought about this that is a risk that I had not considered, is if like you're perceived as handling COVID or you're perceived as handling some kind of police shooting poorly in your area, that's probably going to be harmful to you in the ticket versus Kamala Harris and Warren and Duckworth aren't really in charge of anything. And so that does make them sort of like nominally more less risky because like governing choices do matter right now. People are looking at those closely. I think that's an interesting point.
So we mentioned a lot of people here. There, you know, there's Michelle Lujan Grisham, there's Tammy Baldwin. I don't know what the short list exactly looks like. Does anyone want to say anything about those possibilities or anyone else who's out there as a potential pick?
Michelle Obama?
You had to go there.
I'm sorry. The Scottish teens have her as like the fourth or fifth most likely nominee. I don't think it would happen.
Out of respect for Michelle Obama, we should exclude her from this narrative.
Thank you.
Is that a Taylor Swift line?
It is.
So my final thought is this is a big pick in terms of how you see Joe Biden and how, and I think that's the important thing is like, Nate kind of hinted at this and I'll say it directly. I sort of see Joe Biden as a person with a big lead and a sort of a fairly conventional, traditional politician who doesn't take a lot of big risk. So I think it's very likely he picks Kamala Harris. I think it's somewhat likely he picks Susan Rice. I would be surprised but not shocked if he's picked Elizabeth Warren. And I would be astounded if he picked anybody beyond those three. Because I'm not trying to make a prediction because I don't really care about predictions. But I do think in this case, it's worth sort of thinking about how do you see the person as a politician? And if they will like I thought Mitt Romney would pick a governor for, like Paul Ryan was not the bravest pick in the world. But it was a little bit surprising that Mitt Romney didn't pick another senator or governor is what I expected from him. Like Obama, like I wrote about Tim Kaine being picked in January 2016. That was, Hillary did exactly what I thought she would do. I wrote in February that I thought it would be Kamala Harris. And so if Biden does not pick Kamala Harris and if he doesn't pick one of those three, I'll be surprised. I'll be happy to be wrong. I'm not happy, but it'll be interesting to be wrong. But I think it'll sort of change my thoughts about his own thinking and what I think about him.
No, I mean, I think that is right. That like, look, usually these picks follow a fairly predictable trajectory unless someone's way behind and then they are bolder, right? I mean, there's like not any particular reason to deviate from that strategy, right? This is not some game theoretic optimal spot where you have to like use deception or something like that, right? I mean, there's a little bit of deception, like, you know, sometimes I do wonder if like all these mini bubbles around Val Demings or maybe even Susan Rice, although she seems to be taken very seriously, right? I do wonder if some of this is like maybe he's going to pick Harris and like he's trying to build a little bit of intrigue to make her seem less inevitable. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we will know soon enough, and we will convene an emergency podcast when that does happen. But until then, we'll just let the speculation ride. So let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.